Hi, this is Cindy Lin, and you're listening to the 30-Day Home Staging Challenge podcast. This is my weekly podcast where I talk about home staging, home improvement, DIY, styling and decorating your home, and occasionally running a creative small business using my 11 years in real estate and styling. You can find out more about me and the show at stagedformore.com. Today's show is sponsored by EcoJoe, the eco-friendly St. Joseph statue home selling kit. EcoJoe is actually our in-house product. In real estate, there's a common practice where home sellers would bury St. Joseph statues for good luck. However, all the statues were made with plastic until EcoJoe came along. After learning there's so much waste in the real estate industry, we developed EcoJoe and hope to create conversations about environmental issues in real estate. You can find out more about EcoJoe at www.stagemore.com/EcoJoe. Hi guys, welcome back to our show. Hope you all had a great 4th of July. After our two-week break, I'm super excited today to interview Patty Hume, a realtor and landscaping designer based in Echo Park, Los Angeles, California, on today's show. Her work in landscaping is beautiful, and she has done some incredible projects, like the Fountains of the Bellagio in Las Vegas. I feel that her unique background can help a lot of you, especially with a curb appeal. She's incredibly knowledgeable about real estate and also how to work with both residential and commercial clients on their landscaping projects. Without further ado, let's start today's show. Thank you so much for being on the show. Again, I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, and I think you have such a great, unique background. I was reading your bio. It's such an amazing journey that you've took to come to real estate. I see that you have a BFA in textile, and you work for some really, really interesting big commercial projects under wet design. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, you know, I think, you know, a lot of these things, I think the trajectory in your life kind of starts early. By the time I was 6 years old, I wanted to grow up and be an architect for Disney World. And, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. My great-grandfather was an award-winning architect who did some innovative work with curved steel structures. And so I grew up in a family that appreciated design and architecture. We lived in a lot of historic homes growing up from the 1850s, 1890s, you know, mid-century complexes that my grandfather designed. So I grew up kind of being looking at things and being interested in pattern and color and repetition. So, you know, I ended up going to art school, and originally I thought I was going to be a painter, but I ended up getting really seduced by working with textiles and fiber and embroidery and weaving. But the interesting thing is when I was working with textiles, I was always imagining them as like diagrams for cities or for larger systems and ideas. Starting to read a lot about urban planning and Jane Jacobs and, you know, people who were thinking about cities, landscapes, and how they were developing while I was working on textiles. So that sort of led to another, and I ended up going to the University of Pennsylvania to get my master's degree in landscape architecture and regional planning. And it was an exciting time to be there. There were a lot of really, you know, I would say influential thinkers in the field there at the time, James Corner, Laurie Olin, John Dixon Hunt. So it was an exciting time. We were working on a lot of like really large scale projects. I think the smallest project I worked on in grad school was like a city block. So we were thinking in big city scale terms. When I graduated from there, I worked on the East Coast for a while, designing residential landscapes. And then I ended up coming out to LA, and I, you know, this is back in 2002. You know, wet design is probably most well known for the Fountains of the Bellagio in Las Vegas. They create kind of these large scale urban sized projects that really bring people together for collective experiences. Many of them involve water, but some of them also involve like light shows, fire. Some are choreographed to music. Others are a little bit more subtle and, you know, architectural and contemplative. But it was a really incredible opportunity for me early on in my career to get to work on large-scale projects all over the world. When I was at WET, I started out as a project designer, and then I was promoted to senior designer, and then later I managed the design department. And we spent a lot of time traveling. I think there were years where I was gone, you know, more than 50% of the year. We spent a lot of time in the Middle East and Asia. There were 18 months where it was crazy. I was going back and forth between LA and Abu Dhabi 1 week out of every month. So it was exciting and fun. We got to see a lot of projects being built around the world, and it was, you know, just a really inspiring time. But, you know, as things happen, the recession hit, and a lot of construction around the world slowed down. So people really weren't building multi-million dollar water futures. And, you know, a lot of architects and landscape architects that I know were unemployed or underemployed. It was just sort of a slow time for a couple of years. And during that time, I started working on residential landscapes again in LA, which, you know, turned out to be a really great thing for me because I see residential landscape kind of as laboratories for ideas. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's a smaller scale where you can be a little bit more innovative and take risks and collaborate with your clients. So that's been really fun for me. And we've done some really nice work the last few years. But, you know, at the same time, I was starting to have contractors and developers, flippers come to me and ask me to help them pick land for new projects. Los Angeles is an interesting city, and then there's still a lot of land, empty lots within the city that are, you know, with the kind of the renaissance of building activity here right now, a lot of people are looking to do infill projects. So with my background in landscape architecture, people are asking me as a, from a design standpoint to, you know, think about how programs of buildings could be laid out on land in the city. So it was really a little bit of regional planning, like identifying land, but also master planning, like what you could do with that land. And I found that work pretty fascinating. And I had done some of that years ago when I was on the East Coast. I did some site selection for a large science center that they were building on the Hudson River. So it's something I've always liked to think about in terms of kind of putting my developer's cap on and thinking about what could be in a place. And through doing that, I got more interested in real estate. And I realized if I'm going to be doing that kind of work and trying to put together some of these real estate deals, I need to know more about real estate. So initially, I wasn't even really planning to get my real estate license. I was just wanted to be more knowledgeable about the topic. And I started taking classes at my local community college here in LA. And through that, you know, I realized I'm taking all the classes I need to get licensed. It makes sense to just keep going and to become a realtor and just kind of see where that takes me. And, you know, I think at first I wasn't, you know, I was just really trying to get paid for that type of work I was already doing. But, you know, I came to realize there's a real great synergy between, you know, having the skills to design landscapes and, you know, look at land and the city and, you know, having knowledge about real estate. So it's, you know, kind of been a circuitous route to get here, but I think it's, you know, they kind of fit together really well.
I think that's amazing. You have such a really unique and diverse background. So how does it, like, how, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is you have worked on such large projects around mm-hmm. the world. And how do you find that's different than working in residential landscaping?
You know, there's a lot of similarities between them. I think some people have the ability to work at different scales, and I just do because I think of my background and training, and other people are just used to working really big or used to working really small. And I think that it's hard for them to apply things at a larger scale. But, you know, when I'm thinking on really big citywide projects, like I've done some, you know, design guidelines for like new cities being built in the Middle East, you know, you try to think of things in, you have to organize things, and you have different districts within a project, and then you have different rules that you're applying to how the landscape works within each district. So, and then you apply those things on a smaller scale. So I think that they, you know, they complement one another, and it's just about kind of using logic and, you know, and rules and strategies to make things be, you know, to make sense with each other and to create a unique character for a certain, you know, project or district or area.
Cool. And I love that you mentioned LA a little bit, because I don't know if most of our listeners are familiar with how your local market is like. It's really mm-hmm. interesting you're telling me that there's actually plenty of land that's still being developed right now. Whereas in Bay Area, up here, there's so little land, so people are starting to get squeezed out of the city. And so, flowing into suburban areas.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because LA is going through a really exciting time right now. I've been, you know, here since 2002, and I've seen such a dramatic change even in the last, you know, 12 years. I live in Angelino Heights. It's a historic neighborhood near downtown Los Angeles. So where I live, it's mostly homes from like the 1890s to maybe about 1920. But we're only about a mile from downtown Los Angeles, so we can see all the skyscrapers out our windows. In many ways, there's old parts of our city, Los Angeles, that have been kind of a bit run down for decades. There hasn't been a lot of investment in a lot of the older neighborhoods. As LA has grown, it's like grown out, and the newer developments have been farther away from the city center. So there's really been, for a variety of reasons, there's been a renaissance going on in the city. Our LA River corridor is being revitalized, and there are not a lot of new building projects along it. We're kind of really going through a housing crunch right now. There are a lot of people coming to LA, and we just don't, honestly, we don't have enough housing. Historically, LA has been undervalued as a world city. You know, when you think of Hong Kong, Tokyo, Moscow, right. Paris, you know, we think it's expensive here, but honestly, when you look at the world market, we've been undervalued. And that's why there's so much foreign investment that's been flowing into Los Angeles for a long time, but it's really spiked in the last 5 years. And a lot of that's going more to the west side in LA. But we're starting to get some of it coming directly more into the east side where I am. But what we're also seeing is that a lot of people who would normally want to be buying homes on the west side are getting priced out because of tech money and foreign investment. Prices towards the beach are extremely high. So there are a lot of people who may have been renting over there who can't afford to buy. So we're seeing a lot of people from the west side buying homes on the east side. We also see, and you may know people up in the Bay Area, but we're seeing a lot of people from the Bay Area, the creative class, starting to migrate down to Los Angeles too, who are being kind of priced out by the high prices in the tech industry.
Yeah, I definitely feel the same way about that. I'm actually going to downtown LA next week. And from what I understand, I think last time I went was, 5 or 6 years ago. But now it's like a total new part of the LA.
It's really changed. Yeah. We should get coffee when you're in town. Let me know.
I would love that. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, definitely. I'm staying at the Ace. And it's changed a lot, I feel like. Because I was doing a little bit of research. I love to eat. So I've been looking at places to eat and then, spaces to visit and stuff. So it's really fascinating how the city has changed, especially just in the downtown area.
Yeah, and it's, I would say even in the last 5 years, it's very different. There used to be no grocery store now, downtown, and now there's a Ralph's, there's a Whole Foods that's opening this summer. Like, it's becoming easier for people to live downtown. And, they've been trying to do that for decades, but it's suddenly just really happening. I think the younger generation, the millennials, really appreciate being in more of a walking urban community. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of factors that are happening right now, but I really, it's an exciting time to be in LA.
Yeah. And it's interesting you brought up the younger, more tech type of buyers, because according to National Association of Realtors, I think latest study, they're really the one that is buying houses right now.
Yeah. Well, I think the millennials account for 25% of the population already. I just see them. They're different kind of buyers. They're smart. They're tech savvy. They're, for the most part, they're finding the properties they want, and then coming to the realtor to negotiate the deal. So I find them more hands on. They're great to work with in that way.
That's awesome. Yeah, because they already did their homework before they come to you, so they're very clear in terms of what they want. And it's kind of fascinating how the whole millennial generation is actually changing the way our cities are. Definitely we see that in San Francisco up here as well. It's definitely becoming more urban, more walking friendly, more shops, and more creative outlets, which I think is also very exciting.
Yeah, I think it is. And I personally like being in an area where I feel like there's a lot going on, where I can walk. There are a number of bars and restaurants I can walk to. Yet I live in a neighborhood with big trees and yards, and it's kind of it's urban, but there's some suburban aspects to it as well.
Cool. And so I want to bring the conversation back to landscaping a little bit more, because you have such a unique perspective. So when you are doing landscaping projects, usually what kind of timeline and budget is homeowner looking at, or it just depends on projects?
It depends a lot on the projects, but I would say in the part of the city that I live in, there tend to be a lot of smaller, older homes. There are a lot of craftsmen's that are maybe like two bedrooms, maybe three bedrooms. So smaller, I would say smaller homes on bigger lots. So there's a lot of opportunity to create indoor-outdoor living. Many of my clients come to me with, you know, maybe a $10,000 to $30,000 budget to do landscaping work for this season, although they may want to eventually spend more, but a lot of times the work gets phased over time. So it really just depends on what they're trying to achieve. If they already have a lot of hardscape and they just want to do planting, that's not as expensive. But if they want to put in new patios and walls and fences and, you know, a more elaborate situation, you start looking at $20,000, $30,000 or more.
Right. And what do you think, what do you see are some of the major trends right now in landscape design?
I think for us here in Southern California, it's really about creating outdoor living space. Mm-hmm. You know, people want to be able to be outside. In the climate here, you can really do that 12 months out of the year. So, how people are doing that right now, one of the big trends is, you know, having outdoor living rooms, like big sectional couches. A bunch of companies, including IKEA, are putting out couches with upholstery that can be outdoors. So you can really have a similar setup to what you have inside, outside. You can work on the, you know, you can take naps, you can read, you can watch TV, you can work on your iPad. So we're seeing a lot of outdoor living spaces that are like comfy and more like an interior space, outdoor dining rooms. I would say as another general trend when we're talking about like sort of generations, I don't think people have as much time to work and maintain their yards that they did 20 years ago. We just have so many things competing for our attention these days. And people tend to have such stressy, busy weeks. On the weekends, they just want to be hanging out and kind of chillaxing in their yard. They don't want to be doing a lot of yard work. So finding ways to make things use less water and be more drought tolerant, but also, I think, easier to maintain.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's really interesting that there's an outdoor living space trend. I definitely see that as well when we're shopping for furniture. Definitely, I see a lot of more like large, like you said, living room sets instead of like the little small bistro sets.
Yeah, because historically, I think outdoor furniture has been like cute, but like really uncomfortable and not something you'd want to sit on for very long. And there's a really strong movement towards creating comfortable, more spa-like, resort-like outdoor spaces.
How do you feel about water features? I've worked on projects where the client has water features for their home in their outdoor space. Do you think that's something that's really great for return on investment, or you think it's something that's going out of trend?
I think the sound of babbling water is really compelling. I think there's something for humans about being near water and hearing water that calms us. That's very meditative. It's sort of reassuring that everything is okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say I just listed a house this week that has a water, kind of a waterfall cascade in the backyard. And I make sure that it's running whenever we show the house because it really brings the place to life. I don't know if people hear it, but they are hearing it. It sets a tone and a mood for the house that I think is really important. I wouldn't spend a ton of money on a water feature, but if you can do it in a cost-effective way, and it could even be a tabletop one or, you know, a portable unit, having the sound of water is really compelling.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Because I remember going to those projects and it was like, you know, you're working and you're like, oh my God, like just seeing the water feature makes you feel so much more relaxed.
I think so. Yeah. And quite frankly, if they're recirculating the water and it's you're not really losing much to evaporation. I don't see it as a water conservation issue.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for bringing that up. That's a big concern in California right now. I don't know how it is in LA. I'm sure it's the same. Like, we're getting all these notices from the city saying that we are on strict, like, watering schedule and all that mm-hmm. stuff. So,
yeah. it's a huge issue here. And I really think that it is what's driving a lot of the landscape work that's going on right now. We have rebates here in Los Angeles County at $3.75 for every square foot of turf that you remove. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people want to cash in on the rebate while the funds are available in order to do some updating to their yard. So one of the big things right now is taking out lawns or reducing the size of them and putting in more drought-tolerant plantings or, you know, sometimes they want more outdoor living spaces, so it's maybe extending patios and making space for that. But there are a lot of ways that people can be more drought-tolerant. One is installing drip irrigation. Usually when people have lawns and have an older irrigation system, there's spray heads that pop up and spray water when the irrigation comes on. they're not that efficient in terms of, you know, they're kind of spring water even where you don't need them. You're losing more to evaporation in the wind. But with drip irrigation, you have like a network of tubes that are interconnected that slowly drip water out just where you need it. So you're not losing as much to evaporation, and you're able to water where you want to water and not water other places, which also helps with cutting down on weeds.
That's awesome. Yeah, definitely. My mom's been changing her sprinkler system into drips, and she likes it a lot. It's actually easier for us to maintain.
It's actually pretty inexpensive too, because if you already have an irrigation system, it's a quick fix. Anyone can do it. You can go to Home Depot and get these converter heads. You unscrew like a spray head and you screw on this other head that has little outlets for drip tubing. So I think it's like $8 or $9. So it's actually very simple and inexpensive to convert over at least some of your yard to drip irrigation.
That's awesome. And what are some of the easy fixes for homeowners to add value to their curb appeal and without like having a major investment?
Oh, there's a lot of things that you can do. One of the things that I like to see is, you know, creating an attractive entryway to the home. You know, that can be putting like a cheerful, bright color on the front door, some pots with flowers, you know, on the, if there's a porch or on steps going up to the house, changing out the numbers on the house with something more contemporary, or the mailbox if it's looking older. Those are great things to do that are kind of DIY scale projects that people can, you know, do on their own if they want to. I would say also look for free resources. A lot of cities, you know, for LA, for example, the city gives away free mulch. They give away free trees. You can get free plants at Plug Mob events. There are a lot of free landscape resources in many cities. And that's a great way for people to add, you know, if they could get free trees to add shade to their parkway or their front yard. Another thing I see a lot around here, we have a lot of older homes, so there's older vegetation, older shrubs, older trees, a lot of times that are kind of overgrown. I was just walking by this house the other day. It's got to be a gorgeous Victorian. You can see one turret sticking up above a tree, but the rest of the facade is completely covered by these overgrown cypress. They were originally shrubs in front of the house, but now they're like 40 feet tall, and they're completely hiding this gorgeous house. So sometimes I think it's about, you know, you don't want to hide the charm of your house. And if the landscaping is doing that, you may want to consider cutting some things back or maybe even removing some things. I see a lot of overgrown foundation planting, meaning the shrubs that are right up against the front of the house. And at some point in time, it may make sense to take them out and replace them with something, you know, that's more of an appropriate scale.
Yeah, no, I love you mentioned that because I've seen that a lot. I mean, we staged this house last year in Burlingame, which is a suburban area here in the Bay Area. I mean, it's a $1.5 million home, but you can't even see it. I mean, the first time I went on a job site visit, I completely drove past it because it just looked like it was somebody's yard. Like it was completely covered with shrub that was overgrown and you really couldn't see it. So yeah, I definitely love that suggestion where you can trim back the vegetation. That would be really great because there are beautiful houses hiding behind that and you want to see it to sell that.
I think so. And you have to remember, like, these days, people, the millennials are really reviewing and touring houses online. They may look at 100 photos or 100 profiles of homes online and go see one or two, you know, in a given week. So the pictures are really important. And if the front photo of a property just looks like vegetation, you can't even see the house, you're going to get less traffic through those open houses. So you want to be able to see a house and really kind of show off its charm.
That's awesome. So we're already talking some about that, but so what are some of the common mistakes that you see homeowners make when it comes to like curb appeal and landscaping?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that people will kind of get wrong. You know, one thing I see that drives me nuts is people picking really ugly mulch for their plant beds. Mulch comes in all, you know, a variety of different colors and textures, from things that are very chunky and barky to things that are very fine and almost feel like soil. And, you know, what I hate is when you see mulch that's really very red or, you know, or just you, when you mulch a bed, you really want it to disappear and look natural. And I think that the best way to do that is to have mulch that is dark brown, dark brownish black, and has a finer texture so that it just basically feels like a more refined layer of topsoil in the beds. So that's one easy thing to do. And I have to say, a lot of cities give mulch away free. So it's an inexpensive thing you can do to make your yard look better or to prepare it for sale, is to remulch all the beds like consistently. Mulch hides a multitude of sins in that there are all kinds of like drip irrigation tubes, potentially like low voltage wires going through beds to landscape lightings. There could be like monument boxes for irrigation. There could be like all these things that are kind of clutter up a bed. But when you put a nice thick 2 or 3 inch layer of mulch over all of that, it kind of just hides everything, cleans everything up really nicely.
Hmm. That's a good point. I actually never thought about it, but it makes total sense. They're pretty and they're ugly mulches.
Yeah. And it really makes a difference. So I think if people aren't sure to like ask for advice or, you know, look and see what their neighbors are doing and try, you know, it's always a great trick to kind of look at your street and see what the greatest house is, you know, in terms of the landscaping, and try to replicate some of the things that they're doing. Because when you're landscaping, you're not in isolation. Your house and your yard are really part of a larger landscape of your street. And it's nice to pick up some things that look good in other people's yards. So there's sort of a sense of repetition and continuity, and it feels like a greater landscape.
I love that, because I never thought about that. I think when people put their home on this market, they just really think of their home as a one singular unit, and they don't really think about it as an overall aesthetic for the entire block. I mean, when we're asked about exterior colors, I usually recommend, well, look at what your neighbors have. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want to be that giant pink house that stick out like a sore thumb from a mile away. You want to kind of blend into the neighborhood so everybody looks, you know, equally kind of pleasing together. So yeah, I think that's a really great recommendation. And yeah, go ahead, sorry.
And also on that theme, you know, one of the things I also see people doing wrong is they may have a lot of mature planting, but they want to plant some more things. But then the new things they add really don't complement the existing plants. They just feel like they're a totally different palette. So, you know, one tip I would give people, you know, if you have some holes in your plant beds that you want to fill in and you're not sure what to put there, I would suggest buying duplicates of some of the other plants you already have and using that to fill in, because it'll just kind of fit together nicely.
I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because that's how my mom gardens. She just buys whatever plants that she likes at the moment, and then she just puts it into the empty space. So when you go see her garden in the back, it's very hodgepodge. I mean, there's succulents on one side, they're like Queen Anne's lace, and then there's like hydrangeas.
That just looks a little bit busy to me. I think it's a bit more contemporary to have a bit more edited plant palette where there aren't as many different things. And it's just kind of a little bit more, I think, relaxing and pleasing to the eye too.
So would you recommend homeowners like basically periodically kind of re-edit their plants? Maybe when they put something in, they should take something out? Like, how do you recommend, like, what's a good process to do that?
Well, you know, I think of plants as plant friends. You're spending a lot of time with plants. You're kind of growing old with them. Mm. And while it's important to have screening and fill in, you know, privacy from the neighbors, I think it's also equally important for everybody in a family to have some plants or trees or shrubs in the yard that they kind of love and like being near. And, you know, you might move into a house and find you really don't like a lot of the plants. And if that's the case, I do think it makes sense to start switching things out and developing a palette that's pleasing to your senses that you're excited, you know, about being with. So I think it's true. Like if you're trying to move in that direction of personalizing your landscape, selectively taking out a few things each season and replacing them with other things makes sense. But I wouldn't do it all at once, because it'll make everything new at the same time, and then everything will be big at the same time. It's better to like take a few things out and then add a few things and let plants be at different sizes in their life cycle.
That's a really good advice. And my other question for you is, you know, like we talk about water conservation a little bit. Do you see a trend in terms of like plant selection, like what kind of stuff people are more favoring right now. For example, I know there's a trend in LA that is having backyard garden instead of having lawns. Or would you recommend native plants? Those are better for water conservations. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it really depends on what people are trying to do. What I see people do most commonly in LA, there's sort of a hybrid palette where people will have some succulents, some drought-tolerant Mediterranean plants, maybe some native plants. I'm flexible on it. I think people like the plants need to be somewhat drought tolerant to survive in our climate right now. But I'm not a stickler for doing pure native landscapes. But for certain properties, it makes sense. I had a new client I was talking to yesterday who has a number of live oaks, very old live oaks, in his yard. And it makes sense that he wants to do a native palette in that those native trees are very dominant in the landscape and he wants to do something that's appropriate that goes with them. A lot of times I find native plants tend to be slow growing. It's part of their conserving energy and being drought tolerant. So if you're trying to get a lot of impact or have a more mature looking landscape quickly, you may be better off with doing more of a hybrid landscape because you're going to need to be patient with the native plants. That being said, I did plant a toyon, which is the tree commonly called a Hollywood. That Hollywood was named after in my front yard, which is a native tree shrub, about 3 years ago. And it actually has gotten quite big. I think it's probably 17 or 18 feet tall right now.
That's cool. That's very cool. And then do you have some of favorite plants that you love to use in your projects?
I do. One of my go-to plants is lavender because it's cheap. It grows quickly. And I find that pretty much everybody loves it. Bees love it. And that it fits into a number of different plant palettes. If people want something more colorful, if people are doing more of a drought-tolerant desert landscape or succulents, it plays well with other plants. And I find that it photographs well, too. So if people are looking for a plant for like an entryway sequence or something like that, just doing like a row of lavender can be a really simple, elegant choice.
That's awesome. And then when the homeowners are going to put their house on the market, but they don't have a lot of budget with landscaping, what are some of the suggestions you normally give to help them to improve that curb appeal?
One is, and I mentioned it earlier, is mulch. I think mulching the beds, even if a bed is somewhat empty and not full of plants, gives it, it makes it look loved and well-maintained. So mulching for sure, filling in some of the gaps in the landscaping, and maybe they need a punch of color. So maybe adding some flowering shrubs to the front yard that would be appropriate. But again, trying to pick up things that you see your neighbors growing that do well in your microclimate and feel like they fit into your neighborhood.
That's great. My one last question is, what is the one tip you always give to the homeowner when it comes to landscaping?
Mulch.
That's awesome.
I feel like a broken record, but I have to say people don't do this right, and I feel like it's overlooked all the time. If you really want your property to look more well-maintained, tidier, and also to show better if you're selling it, mulching all the beds and doing it consistently. What I see is a lot of people will mulch 1 year, and then a year later, like there's an area that needs mulch, so they dump down some mulch over there. So, and it starts looking hodgepodge. Some of it's different colors, like it's kind of inconsistent. You know, every year or two, remulch all the beds so that it's all the same. It's all unified. It helps in the drought because it keeps moisture in. It looks better. It's going to hide a lot of your wires and your irrigation tubing and kind of really clean up the yard.
That's awesome. I think mulch is so, I guess it's kind of the unsung hero in landscaping. I don't think people really understand how important mulch could be and how easy it could be to change your landscaping just by that one little tweak.
I think so. It doesn't sound sexy.
No, it doesn't sound sexy
at all. But you know, really it works.
That's really cool. Yeah. So thank you so much again for being on the show today. I mean, you're just like a wealth of knowledge and it's amazing to be able to interview you.
Oh, thanks. It was fun to be here. I'd love to chat again sometime.
Thank you so much for listening to the 30-Day Home Staging Challenge podcast. Visit stagemore.com/podcast to check out the show notes for each episode and find links for resources mentioned during the podcast. You can also sign up for a free 30-day home staging challenge and webinars by visiting our website. And I want to hear from you. You can leave a comment on the show notes or connect with me on Instagram, Twitter, and Pinterest using the handle @CindyLynnSF or @StageForMore. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud so you never miss an episode. And if you're finding value from the show, please tell a friend and leave a rating and review on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. It'll help people find the show, and then I can invite more guests. Until next time, happy staging!